Having already angered all the plutocrats and would-be plutocrats, but with his credibility at a peak in other quarters, Buffett vowed to carry on the fight against repeal of the estate tax and would spin on this subject for years. He spoke again on another subject to the Democratic Policy Committee just days before the first shots were fired in the Iraq War in 2003. He said that President Bush's plan to cut taxes on dividends was more class welfare for the rich. In the Washington Post, he wrote about dividend voodoo, noting again that his tax rate was lower than Debbie Bosanek's. The reaction from conservatives against yet another of Buffett's populist manifestos was swift and savage. "Millionaires are seething at Warren Buffett's betrayal of their class," said one. That, of course, was his point. He felt that the United States of America was never meant to be a country where people with money were a self-perpetuating class who constantly gathered more wealth and power unto themselves. The rich, however, had been getting very rich indeed as the stock market continued its resurgence after 9/11. A dozen new hedge funds seemed to sprout every day. They were cashing in on all the leverage from the low interest rates the Federal Reserve had provided. So many people were raking in stock options and taking fees of 2% and 20% of other people's money in private equity funds, hedge funds, and funds of funds that billionaires were becoming as common as raccoons around a garbage can. A lot of the quick bucks wealth of the new economy bothered Buffett because of the way it had been transferred in massive amounts from investors to middlemen without producing anything in return. The average investor was still getting, of course, the average return, but with all of these fees gouged out. One of Buffett's least favorite ways for the rich to get richer was through stock options. Since his famous no vote on the pay package at Solomon, no other board had ever asked him to serve on its compensation committee. Coca-Cola had given Doug Daft options on 650,000 shares of its stock in 2001. Daft had originally asked to be compensated with stock options that would pay off only if earnings increased 15% to 20%. The shareholders approved it, with Buffett staring at his shoes thinking, "Okay, this will never happen." A month later, the compensation committee belatedly realized that the target was impossible and Daft would never get paid. It backtracked and bonus pimped for him, lowering the target to 11% to 16%. That was like moving the finish line in a marathon to the 19-mile mark. Buffett couldn't believe it. The shareholders had voted for 26 miles and would be handing out a prize after 19. Another vote for the rich. So far, Daft had not impressed, and Coca-Cola's stock had gone nowhere. Watching trophy-sized option payments proliferate despite rising outrage, Buffett felt he had to seize the opportunity he had been waiting for, to finally kill counterfeit stock option accounting. Managers loved stock options because of a quirk of accounting history that said that if companies paid their employees with options instead of cash, they booked no cost. It was as if the stock options did not exist. In the real world, a privately owned business would instantly recognize this as a bogus idea. If the butcher, baker, and candlestick maker gave away options for shares worth, say, 20% of their businesses, they would be acutely aware that they had just given away a chunk of the profits as well. But the accounting rules had made stock options into play money. Thus, bonus pimping on an incredible scale had begun to occur in the late 1990s. CEOs had, on average, been paid 42 times as much as the average blue-collar worker in 1980. 20 years later, that ratio had increased to more than 400 times. The top-earning CEOs got billion-dollar packages. In 2000, Sandy Weill was paid $151 million at Citigroup, Jack Welch, $125 million at GE, Larry Ellison, $92 million at Oracle. Although Steve Jobs was taking only a dollar salary at Apple from 1997 through 1999, he got a windfall $872 million stock option grant in 2000, plus a $90 million Gulfstream jet. When the accountants had tried to change these rules in the early 1990s, corporate America, led by Silicon Valley, stormed the gates of Congress armed with lobbyists and campaign contributions, begging their representatives to save them from the terrible new accounting rules. Until the bubble finally burst in 2002, they had succeeded in stopping those rules dead in their tracks, and had almost succeeded in murdering the Financial Accounting Standards Board, the accounting rulemaker, to boot. Buffett had been writing about stock options since 1993, but now felt the time was finally ripe for change. He wrote a thundering, influential editorial in the Washington Post, Stock Options and Common Sense. CEOs know what their option grants are worth. That's why they fight for them, he wrote, and repeated the questions he had raised before. If options aren't a form of compensation, what are they? If compensation isn't an expense, what is it? And if expenses shouldn't go into the calculation of earnings, where in the world should they go? At Sun Valley in July 2002, emotions ran high over stock options. Buffett's loudly expressed view, combined with his influence, hung ominously over the heads of the stock option lobby. The thermometer hit triple digits, and the sweating celebrities and corporate chiefs headed off in buses to go rafting and escape the heat. Buffett himself went somewhere else shortly after he arrived, somewhere he needed help to face. Catherine Graham's condominium had been right next to Herbert Allen's, in the Wildflower Group, a spot that people passed by often on their way to and from events. The Coca-Cola board would be convening later for a meeting at Allen's, since most of its members were on site. The purpose was to discuss stock options, and he would not miss this. But first, I was with Bill and Melinda, and we went up to the spot where Kay fell. I was shaking, and I couldn't stop. It was like I had the chills or something. And, you know, they were probably embarrassed. I really wasn't. I was just overcome at that point. Afterward, Buffett was able to perform his ongoing miracle of the bathtub memory and carried on with composure. The Coca-Cola board made a decision during its meeting and announced in a press release that it would start to book the cost of its employee stock options as an expense, which was currently allowed but not required. Nobody else did that. They used an argument like the kid who tells his parents, "It didn't happen, but if it did, I wasn't there. And if I was there, I didn't do it. And if I did, my friends made me." Businesses said that stock options weren't an expense, but if they were an expense, nobody knew how to calculate it. And if they could, the expense shouldn't be deducted from earnings. It should only be disclosed in a footnote, because it might confuse investors to know just how much the executive stock options were worth. So Coca-Cola's announcement hit corporate America like a cluster bomb, its force magnified by the venue at which the new policy was proclaimed, the Sun Valley gathering where the press had dug in outside its flowerpot barricades like an encampment. Buffett's thinly veiled hand could be seen behind this announcement. Right after Sun Valley, the Washington Post Company emulated Coca-Cola and announced that it, too, would expense stock options. Buffett followed up this victory with another salvo, a New York Times editorial, "Who Really Cooks the Books?" "I have a proposition. Berkshire Hathaway will sell you insurance, carpeting, or any of our other products in exchange for options identical to those you grant yourselves. It'll all be cash-free. But do you really think your corporation will not have incurred a cost when you hand over the options in exchange for the carpeting?" Strangely, no one took him up on this offer. Instead, Silicon Valley suited up for another fight in Congress. But one by one, other companies began to follow in the footsteps of Coca-Cola and the Washington Post Company, announcing that they, too, would recognize the expense of stock options on their books. A year later, on the final Saturday morning of Sun Valley 03, Bill Gates spoke and announced that Microsoft was discontinuing the use of stock options. It would simply pay people a different way. From now on, it would use restricted stock, stock that could not be sold for some time. This move took considerable guts. There was a lot of pressure on Microsoft not to do it. A lot. A lot. The Silicon Valley reaction was, "Traitor." Microsoft had a lot of PR people around, advising him what to do. One of them told Gates it was like tossing a match into a room full of gasoline. And my reaction to that was, they're the ones that filled the room with gasoline. The battle over stock options would continue formally for the next 2 years, until the Financial Accounting Standards Board finally made it official. But Coca-Cola's decision had kicked over the domino in a chain of events, and Microsoft's action had broken through the wall of Silicon Valley solidarity that had given the technology industry a united lobbying voice in Washington. Buffett's momentum as an influential statesman during this period was gathering speed. Although the estate tax was still scheduled to be repealed, he found another target in the accountants who had facilitated the accounting frauds of the past few years. If the auditors had not been sitting in the laps of the CEOs, wagging their tails, he felt, then managements would not have been allowed to loot the shareholders' pockets, transferring vast sums into their own pockets. Buffett appeared at an SEC roundtable on financial disclosure and oversight, saying that, instead of lapdogs, shareholders needed guard dogs, and directors who served on audit committees and oversaw the auditors must be Dobermans who hold the auditors' feet to the fire. He said he had a short set of questions for the audit committee at Berkshire Hathaway. If the auditor had prepared the financial statements herself, as opposed to their being prepared by the company's management, would they have been prepared the same way? If the auditor were an investor, could he understand how the company had performed financially from the way the financial statements were presented and described? If the auditor were in charge, would the company follow the same internal audit procedures? Did the auditor know about anything the company had done to change the timing of when sales or costs were reported to investors? If auditors are put on the spot, Buffett said, they will do their duty. If they are not put on the spot, well, we have seen the results of that. These simple questions were so obvious, so clearly defining of right and wrong, so self-evidently useful in sorting out the truth and preventing fraud, that at least one or two other companies with directors who had common sense and were concerned about their exposure to liability from lawsuits actually copied Buffett and began to use them. As Buffett swung his saber with ruthless accuracy, and accountants cowered, and compensation committees ducked and muttered about why he publicized their bonus pimping instead of just shutting up, and as would-be tax cutters tried to find even nastier terms than the ultimate pejorative populist to throw at him, so encouraged was Buffett by all this newfound authority that in the spring of 2002 he outdid himself and endorsed a mattress. He let himself be photographed lounging on the Warren, part of the Berkshire collection sold by the Omaha Bedding Company, as seen on posters of Buffett and His Bed. Now, when he went down to the Nebraska Furniture Mart during the shareholder meeting weekend, he could lie on his own bed while selling his own mattresses. "I finally landed the only job I really wanted in life, a mattress tester," he said. The sage of Omaha, at whom plutocrats railed and tax cutters shook their fists, before whom accountants quivered and stock option abusers fled, whom autograph seekers followed and television lights illuminated, was at heart nothing more than a star-struck little kid, endearingly clueless in many ways about his place in the pantheon. He got excited over and over by fan letters from Z-list celebrities. Every time somebody wrote him to say he was their hero, it was like the first time. When porn star Asia Carrera called him her hero on her website, he was thrilled. He was thrilled to be anybody's hero, but being called a hero by a porn star who was a Mensa member had real cachet. His favorite letters were from college students, but when prisoners wrote and said he was their hero, he was proud that his reputation extended to convicts who were trying to turn around their lives. He would much rather be idolized by porn stars and college students and prisoners than by a bunch of rich businessmen. All this basking in the limelight meant that Debbie Bosanek and Deb Ray had to guard the phone and the door with dogged vigilance. Once, an overexcited woman who flew from Japan to get his autograph arrived in the office. She was so overcome by Buffett's presence that she prostrated herself to worship him and had a sort of conniption on the floor. The secretaries hustled her out. She wrote later that her doctor had given her tranquilizers, and she hoped to be allowed in Buffett's presence again. She sent photographs of herself and wrote letters. "I like being worshipped," Buffett said in a plaintive tone. Nevertheless, the secretaries had their way, and the woman wasn't invited back. Chapter 57. Oracle. Omaha, April to August 2003. Buffett seemed to thrive like a trumpet vine as he grew larger than life. Yet he remained brilliant at balancing his priorities. As requests for his time grew, his view that commitments are sacred and his natural inclination to conserve energy saved him from succumbing to the flattery of being in demand. He did only what made sense and what he wanted to do. He never let people waste his time. If he added something to his schedule, he discarded something else. He never rushed. He always had time to work on business deals, and he always had time for the people who mattered to him. His friends could pick up the phone and call him whenever they liked. He managed this by keeping his phone calls warm-hearted and short. When he was ready to stop talking, the conversation simply died. The kind of friends he had didn't abuse the privilege. While he had many fond acquaintances, he added true friends only at intervals of years. Susie added new friends at intervals of days or weeks. Kathleen Cole handled a gift list that had grown to literally 1,000 people. Susie called herself a geriatric gypsy who lived in the sky. Cole smoothed the way logistically for her to travel for months on end, visiting grandchildren, caring for the sick and dying, vacationing, traveling on foundation business, seeing Warren and the family at scheduled times. Cole packed and unpacked for her, managed her 3 homes and staff, juggled the NetJets timetable, made the hotel reservations, scheduled the pedicures, fended off the phone calls, and organized the latest treasures from Susie's shopping trips. Not only was Susie a woman who couldn't say no, she was a woman who couldn't be reached. Susie was such a nomad, she was so helpless to limit her attention to anyone, and the number of people who felt they had claim to her time had grown so astoundingly that by now even her close friends were allowed to contact her only through Kathleen. Some who loved her grew concerned, although they rarely saw her to say so. No one can have 300 or 400 genuine friendships, argued one. She seemed to run faster all the time. All this chasing, like chasing your tail, was another friend's reaction. You can't have friends if you're not around. But if you're ill, Susie said, I'll have plenty of time for you. Some felt that her compulsion to serve and please had replaced living life in a straight line toward goals of her own. She never spoke her own truth, said one. The metaphysically minded found it significant that her health problems arose in the throat and the gut. They associated the constant accumulation of collections and possessions and non-stop redecoration as an expression of what she was holding in. Her life got heavier and heavier, one person said. Stop, another wanted to tell her. Get some perspective and nurture yourself. But it was as if she couldn't slow down, because if she did, something would happen. Yet many others called her a saint, an angel, and even compared her to Mother Teresa. She gave so much of herself to so many that she struck people as fragile now. The warm woolen cloak she wore against the harshness of the world had grown lacy and thin. But isn't that the nature of a saint, mused one friend, to give of herself until nothing was left? Isn't that exactly what Mother Teresa did? Susie had foot surgery in the spring of 2003 and had to give away her beloved Monolo Blahniks. While laid up, she wrote out her usual list of 900 things for Kathleen Cole to do. The second the doctor released her, she sprang out of bed and off she went. When she traveled, Susie had a decided preference for 5-star service most of the time, although many people had the impression that she usually slept on the floor in a hut. It was true, however, that she sometimes traveled without complaint in circumstances that would daunt many people. Susie sometimes actually did sleep in a hut, even though she suffered from acid reflux and a tendency toward esophageal ulcers severe enough that she normally had to sleep propped up at a 45-degree angle. Warren wanted to spend time with her so badly that he agreed to go to Africa to celebrate her 70th birthday. Howie had started planning this trip, which was to take place late in the spring of 2003, 18 months earlier. It would have been the eighth wonder of the world to see my father in Africa, he says. The Buffetts were going to Londolozi and Finda, two seven-star safari resorts in South Africa. Howie traveled to Africa often. In a characteristic move, his mother had gotten him interested in photographing the suffering people of the continent as well as its wild animals. For his father, he was having a Wall Street Journal and a New York Times flown in daily on the trip. It would be 3 days late, Howie says, but they would get the papers to him. It was going to cost $500 a day, but they would hook it up so he could be online in his room and check the news. They already had the hamburger and french fry thing down because they do that for me. The Buffetts would be leaving for Africa a few weeks after their annual trip to New York, which always followed the annual shareholder meeting. On April 1, 2003, as the shareholder meeting drew near, Berkshire announced the acquisition of a mobile home manufacturer, Clayton Homes. This deal was like many others Berkshire was making at the time, a natural continuation of buying discount assets in the post-Enron slump. The Clayton deal had come about because years of low interest rates had given lenders piggy banks full of cheap money, and that had turned them into pigs. Banks were quick to train customers that low interest rates meant they could buy more stuff for less cash outlay now. Those with equity in houses learned it could be used as a checking account. But whether it was credit cards, houses, or mobile homes, the lenders, in search of growth, increasingly turned to people who were the least able to repay, but wanted to participate in the American dream anyway. In the case of mobile homes, the banks lent money to the manufacturers, who used it to lend money to the buyers. Historically, this process had worked, because if the mobile homemaker made bad loans, it faced the discipline of not getting paid back. But then the mobile homemakers began to sell their loans, handing off the risk of not getting paid back. That was now somebody else's problem. The somebody else who had assumed the problem was an investor. In a process known as securitization, for some years, Wall Street had neatly packaged loans like these and sold them to investors through a collateralized debt obligation, or CDO, debt backed by the mortgages. They combined thousands of mortgage loans from all over the U.S. and sliced them into strips called tranches. The top-tier tranches got first dibs on all the cash flow from a pool of mortgages. The next tranches had second dibs, and so forth down the line. These tranches allowed a rating agency to assign the top AAA rating to the first dib tranches, AA ratings to the second dib tranches, and so on. The banks sold off the tranches to investors. The banks analyzed the likelihood of default using a model based on historical payment patterns. The lending system was changing, however, so that history was becoming less relevant. As lending standards declined, the hedge funds investing in CDOs took on more leverage, as much as $100 in debt per dollar of capital, and the quality of the CDOs, even AAA CDOs, got sludgier. Some investors did get nervous about the more obviously phony aspect of the way the market was operating and wanted to hedge their bets. They tapped into a market that had developed to bet on whether loan defaults would occur, the credit default swap. If a securitization lost value because loans defaulted, the issuer of the swap would have to pay. Protected by credit default swaps, investing in CDOs now appeared to contain no risk. When money is free, wrote Charles Morris later, and lending is costless and riskless, the rational lender will keep on lending until there was no one left to lend to. If it was pointed out that risk did not disappear, those who participated in the market would explain with a sigh that securitization and swap derivatives spread the risk to the far corners of the globe, where it would be absorbed by so many people that it could never hurt anyone. Thus freed, the rational people of the mobile home business had lowered down payments, making it much easier to get loans. As the real estate market boomed, riskier types of home loans, along with commercial and business and student and other loans, spread like a cold virus in a kindergarten. These, like the mobile home loans, were stripped, insured, securitized, and speculated on over and over through credit default swaps. Meanwhile, other, more exotic derivatives proliferated. In his 2002 shareholder letter, Buffett called derivatives toxic and said they were time bombs that were expanding unchecked and could cause a chain reaction of financial disaster. At the shareholder meeting that year, Charlie Munger described the accounting incentives to exaggerate profits on derivatives and concluded, "To say derivative accounting in America is a sewer is an insult to sewage." In his 2003 letter, Buffett wrote of derivatives as financial weapons of mass destruction. So many of these deals existed, he wrote, that they had formed a daisy chain around the globe. Despite the advice of their mathematical models to buy rather than sell into a crisis, when trouble approached, investors fled their watering hole like a herd of giraffes escaping a lion. And while many people appeared to be participating in a market, in fact, a handful of large financial institutions would always tend to dominate it using their leverage. They would also have other assets that seemed uncorrelated with these derivatives, but which would actually move in tandem with the derivatives in a collapsing market. General Re had a derivatives dealer, General Re Securities, which Buffett had shut down, either selling its positions or letting them run off in 2002. He had already turned Gen Re Securities into the cautionary tale of derivatives, writing at length to the shareholders about the expensive and problematic cost of shutting it down. General Re had made Buffett so angry by losing almost $8 billion by now from insurance underwriting that he could barely talk about it. The scarlet letter remained posted on the Berkshire website, though Ron Ferguson had retired, replaced by Joe Brandon and his number two, Tad Montross. General Re's competitors gleefully told clients that Buffett was going to sell the company or shut it down. Given the example of Solomon, these predictions were not spun from gossamer. Buffett had taken away part of General Re's new business after 9/11 and given it to Ajit Jain's Berkshire Re, rather than infuse more capital into General Re to shore up its balance sheet. He had also started funding competitors of General Re through Jain and through Lloyd's of London. He rationalized this in various ways. He himself may not have recognized a classic pattern. When anxious, Buffett always sought escape hatches and trap doors. He was not punishing General Re. Rather, Buffett was instinctively hedging the risk that General Re was going to underwrite itself, his $22 billion investment, and his reputation into the ground. It was going to take billions of profits before General Re groveled its way back into Buffett's good graces. Its derivatives business would have little to do with that either way. The same was not true for the global economy. By a low but not insignificant probability, Buffett said, sooner or later, he didn't know when, derivatives could lead to a major problem. Munger was more blunt. "I'll be amazed," he said, "if we don't have some kind of significant blow-up in the next 5 to 10 years." While many safeguards had been put in place to protect investors in stock and bond markets, derivatives were lightly regulated and subject to minimal disclosure. Since the early 1980s, deregulation had turned the markets into the financial equivalent of a rugby scrum. The theory was that the market's forces were self-policing. And yet, the Fed did seem to intervene at times when trouble cropped up. By problem and blow-up, Buffett and Munger meant that a bubble was brewing in this witch's cauldron of easy credit, lax regulation, and big paydays for the banks and their accomplices. They meant an unsnarlable traffic jam of claims from derivatives leading to financial institution failures. Large losses at financial institutions could lead to a credit seizure, a global run on the bank. In a credit seizure, lenders become afraid to make even reasonable loans, and the resulting lack of financing sends the economy spiraling downward. Credit seizures had in the past tipped the economy over the edge into depressions. But that's not a prediction, it's a warning, said Buffett. They were giving a mild wake-up call. Many people argue, wrote Buffett in 2003, that derivatives reduce systemic problems in that participants who can't bear certain risks are able to transfer them to stronger hands. These people believe that derivatives act to stabilize the economy, facilitate trade, and eliminate bumps for individual participants. On a micro level, Buffett wrote, these things were often true. But on a macro level, Derivatives could someday cause mid-air collisions over Manhattan, London, Frankfurt, Hong Kong, and other parts of the globe. He and Munger believed that derivatives should be regulated, more disclosure should be required, they should be traded through a central clearinghouse, and the Federal Reserve should act as a central banker to the major investment banks, not just the commercial banks. Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan, however, defended the unregulated market and made sport of Buffett's wariness. Buffett's financial weapons of mass destruction was quoted everywhere, often paired with a question about whether he was overreacting. Even as early as 2002, however, the beginnings of mass destruction could be seen in the mobile home industry. Stung by bad loans, lenders were cutting off funding or raising interest rates to prohibitive levels. Clayton was not Buffett's first foray into the mobile home business. In late 2002, Oakwood Homes, a mobile home manufacturer, and Conseco, a subprime lender that made loans to people without good enough credit ratings to get a cheaper loan, went bankrupt. Buffett knew that the first sign of a deflating credit bubble is when the bankruptcy wolf cuts a weak sheep out of the pack. He lent some money to Oakwood and made a bid on Conseco Finance, the lending arm of Conseco. Cerberus Capital and two other private equity firms, which had been bidding on the property, topped his offer to buy Conseco Finance out of bankruptcy for $1.37 billion. Because they had to outbid him, Buffett's involvement had cost Cerberus, by some accounts, as much as $200 million, a fact the firm would not forget. Buffett then joined two other funds to finance Oakwood through its bankruptcy in a deal that would make him Oakwood's largest shareholder once the mess unraveled. And that, incidentally, would help Oakwood in paying back its loans. Not long after, a group of college students from the University of Tennessee had come to hear Buffett talk in the Cloud Room on the 15th floor of Kiewit Plaza. He took questions for a couple of hours and expounded at length on his latest interest, the manufactured housing industry. Al Auksher, the professor who had arranged for this audience with Buffett, had a student present a gift. First, A Dream, a memoir by Jim Clayton, who had founded Clayton Homes. Buffett called Clayton, who passed the call on to his son Kevin, who had succeeded him as CEO in 1999. Clayton Homes was the class act of the troubled manufactured housing industry. Even though it was fundamentally sound, its lenders were behaving, as Buffett said, like Mark Twain's cat, who, having once sat on a hot stove, wouldn't sit on a cold one. Buffett felt that Clayton's problem was mainly that its financing was drying up, and with enough money it could lead the industry to a better business model. Clayton's stock had fallen with the rest of the industry to as low as $9. The Claytons, like Solomon during its crisis, were starting to run out of funding sources. They were motivated to sell. Kevin Clayton: we might entertain an offer in the $20 range. Buffett: well, it's not likely that we could ever come up with a number that would repay the sweat and time and energy that you and your father have built into this wonderful organization. Clayton: our financing is getting tight. How about if you just lend to us? Buffett: that doesn't work well for Berkshire Hathaway. Why don't you just throw together whatever you have lying around that tells about your company and send it to me someday whenever you have a chance? This classic Buffett maneuver, casting the line, resulted in the arrival of a massive Federal Express package the next day. The fish had snapped at the bait. The Claytons were like Z. Wayne Griffin, who had been willing to flip a coin over the phone to set a price for blue-chip stamps. Buffett knew the Claytons were ready to deal. Wall Street valued Clayton at more than all of its competitors combined, and its reputation was deserved. Most of the other mobile home manufacturers were closing retail stores and losing money. Like most cult stocks, it had a founder with a strong, charismatic personality. Jim Clayton, the company's guitar-picking chairman, a sharecropper's son who had started the business by refurbishing and selling a single mobile home, thought of his shareholder meetings as mini-festivals and had once strolled up the aisle from the rear of the room toward the stage singing, "Take Me Home, Country Roads." He delegated the negotiating to Kevin, who was a businessman like his father, but not so much of a showman. Kevin, of course, had never heard of buffeting. Buffett: $12.50 bid. Clayton: You know, Warren, the board might entertain something in the high teens, more like $17 or $18 a share. Buffett, $12.50 bid. Kevin Clayton got off the phone and went and talked to the board. Even though the stock had recently traded around $9, it was a hard nut to swallow that the company was worth only $12.50. Clayton, the board would consider 15. Buffett, $12.50 bid. Although not part of the official record, by this point he had almost certainly applied his other classic maneuver, the circular saw, slicing the floor out from under the Claytons by stressing, in a sympathetic way, how weak and vulnerable they were going to be with their funding sources drying up. The Claytons and their board went through some further processes. Clayton, we'd like $13.50. Buffett, $12.50 bid. More discussion. Clayton, okay, we'll take $12.50 on the condition that we get Berkshire stock. Buffett, I'm sorry, that's not possible. By the way, I don't participate in auctions. If you want to sell to me, you can't shop this bid against me to any other buyer. You have to sign an exclusive that you won't entertain any other offers. The Claytons, who perhaps understood the direction that their industry was headed better than most experts did at the time, capitulated. After buffeting the Claytons, Warren flew out to Tennessee to meet them, tour the plants, and visit with local Knoxville dignitaries. He had asked Jim Clayton to pick and sing with him, and they had rehearsed a couple of songs over the phone. But when the time came, he forgot all about my guitar on the stand beside him, wrote Clayton later. Give our new friend Warren a microphone, and he forgets all about time. Not used to being upstaged, Clayton at least had the consolation of being the guy who brought the famous Warren Buffett to Knoxville. Yet while the local folks were mostly pleased with the deal, investors in Clayton were not. Buffett's aura worked against him for the first time. Many of the investors knew about buffeting, even if the Claytons didn't, and they were in no mood to be buffeted themselves. After the deal was announced, shareholders began to besiege the Claytons, pleading, "You're a great company, the best in the industry. If I'm going to own somebody in the industry, I want to own you. Please don't go away. You'll get through this, and the industry will come bouncing back again." Or threatening, "How dare you sell this company at $12.50 when it's been as high as $16 and we've weathered the storm? The industry is getting ready to come back. How could you even think of selling it that cheap?" Clayton's large investors thought Buffett was buying at the bottom of the cycle for mobile homes and had opportunely timed the deal to catch a bounce. At its peak in 1998, the manufactured housing industry, using aggressive lending tactics, had shipped 373,000 homes a year. By the end of 2001, that number was down to 193,000 as the economy suffered in the wake of 9/11, and the outlook for 2003 was a measly 130,000. But surely it would turn. Buffett's history as a savvy trader convinced them that he must have bottom-ticked the price and that they would be suckers if they sold the company now. That was not what Buffett saw, however. He saw that the mobile home market had backed itself into a corner by using easy financing terms to make a large percentage of its sales to people who could not afford to buy a home. Therefore, the number of homes sold by the industry was not going to bounce. But the dissidents knew how successful Clayton had been, and, given the numbers, were sure the situation would reverse. They were stewing, talking on the phone far away from Omaha. Unperturbed by shareholder outrage, Buffett reveled in the thought of his future role as a mobile home impresario. He kind of liked the trailer park aspect of the thing, and buying a company from a sharecropper's son appealed to the man who ate dilly bars at Dairy Queen, still lusted over modeled train catalogs, owned a company that made prison uniforms, and got a huge kick out of having his picture taken with the Fruit of the Loom guys. The P.T. Barnum in him was already beginning to stir. He could picture it so vividly, a giant mobile home installed in the exhibition space down in the basement of Omaha's new Quest Convention Center at the 2004 shareholder meeting, next to the See's candy shop, maybe, or over by the area where the Justin people were selling boots. The exhibition space kept getting bigger and more dramatic, with more vendors and more merchandise for sale every year. The thought of a whole house right there in the middle of his shareholder meeting, with a lawn even, and shareholders lined up to get into the house, gaping in awe, delighted him. How many mobile homes could you sell at a shareholder meeting, he wondered. None of the guys at Sun Valley ever sold a mobile home at their shareholder meetings. Not only that, but Clayton was another company that married his business instincts with his urge to preach. He was going to give the bad actors of the mobile home business hellfire and damnation. He was going to lead the mobile home business to financial salvation. Buffett called in Ian Jacobs, his new project guy. They had a brief conversation. Ian, here's a file on Clayton. It gives you all kinds of dope on foreclosures and advances. Now, I'd like you to go out and see some retail dealers, and I'd like you to do a scuttlebutt approach to learning how this damned business works. The more you can learn about the sales practices, Ian, if there's any real change going on from how it was done in the past, and who does it right and who does it wrong, I would just soak up everything you can about what is going on and what is the logical way of conducting a business like this. Like Mark Hamburg, Berkshire's chief financial officer, and others before him, Ian's ability to interpret and work off directions like this with virtually no further instructions or supervision would be crucial to his career at Berkshire Hathaway. For the right kind of person, it was the learning opportunity of a lifetime. Ian flew off to Scuttlebutt. By the end of the month, shareholders jammed every flight into Omaha's airport and filled every hotel room in town for the 2003 shareholders meeting to see the man whom popular magazines had been proclaiming the comeback crusader and the oracle of everything. And there was some surprising news, too. The Hong Kong Stock Exchange had disclosed that Berkshire had bought a stake in PetroChina, the giant, mostly state-owned Chinese oil company. It was Buffett's first publicly acknowledged foreign investment in many years. He was notoriously cautious about investing outside the U.S. and had not owned a significant position in a foreign stock since Guinness PLC in 1993. Reached by reporters hungry for an explanation of this radical departure from the past, Buffett said he knew nothing much about China and had bought it for the oil that was denominated in yuan, the Chinese currency. He was pessimistic about the dollar and optimistic about oil. Buffett had written an article for Fortune, Why I'm Down on the Dollar, in which he explained that he had made significant investments in foreign currencies out of a belief that the dollar would decline in value. The reason was something called the trade deficit. Americans were buying more from other countries than they were selling, and at a fast accelerating rate. They were paying for the difference through borrowing. Foreigners were buying treasury bonds, an IOU from the U.S. government. In short order, the country's net worth, he said, is being transferred abroad at an alarming rate. He posited a hypothetical example of two countries called Thriftville and the deficit spending Squanderville. Sooner or later, the Thriftville citizens who were buying Squanderville treasury bonds started wondering if Squanderville was good for the money. When that happened, they still traded with Squanderville, but instead of bonds, they took less risky hard assets, land, businesses, office buildings. And eventually, wrote Buffett, the thrifts own all of Squanderville. To ward off the United States becoming a version of Squanderville that was selling off pieces of itself to other countries, Buffett proposed a system in which United States companies that exported would be issued import certificates, in total about $80 billion a month. They could trade these, like the old warehouse certificates issued by Rockwood Chocolates could be traded. Anybody wanting to import into the United States would need an import certificate and would have to buy from an exporter. Presto! Companies would get paid a higher price to export than to sell domestically, automatically increasing exports. That, of course, would increase the importers, foreign companies, costs. While this system could be viewed as unfriendly, a tariff or tax on imports, which in the past had led to trade wars that depressed economies, Buffett felt that importers were going to suffer anyway as their goods became more expensive with the falling dollar. The import certificate idea at least used the market to allocate who was willing to suffer. Over time, Demand for import certificates would gradually increase exports to rebalance trade and restore parity between Thriftville and Squanderville. The plan had many nuances, but its bottom line was hallmark Buffett in many ways. The article showcased Buffett's thinking. It was a lesson on economics. It was a warning of potential catastrophe. It had a margin of safety. While it might not improve the trade balance as much as he hoped, the market mechanism meant it was unlikely to make things worse. It was a blend of market and government solution. It was a complex, ingenious, comprehensive system, and, of course, a no-risk deal in which most parties would be at least somewhat better off than the alternative of doing nothing. Executing it would also require a wholesale change in thinking. A coalition of politicians would have to grasp the economics and care deeply enough about them to take the considerable political risk of pushing through Buffett's idea. Moreover, the plan would attack a problem before it had turned into a crisis, always unlikely in Washington. The odds of anything remotely resembling a tariff being enacted into law with President Bush and free marketers controlling the White House were zero. Thus, the import certificates were an elegant solution that was going absolutely nowhere. Buffett's father, however, would have been extremely proud of him. And at least Buffett would have the honor of being the first prominent figure to go on record warning, loudly, about the risk of a falling dollar. To hedge that risk for Berkshire, he had been looking at Chinese stocks because of China's burgeoning economic power. He had found PetroChina, studied it, and gotten comfortable enough to buy it. Although he was able to purchase only $488 million, he said he wished he could have bought more. His endorsement of PetroChina sent investors over the moon. Warren Buffett had bought a foreign stock. PetroChina soared, and so did attendance at the BRK shareholders' meeting. That year, 15,000 people came to Omaha's Woodstock for Capitalists. Buffett's $36 billion fortune was once again exceeded only by Bill Gates. He had bounced back, almost to the top of the heap. "What is the ideal business?" a shareholder asked when the questions began. "The ideal business is one that earns very high returns on capital and that keeps using lots of capital at those high returns. That becomes a compounding machine," Buffett said. "So if you had your choice, if you could put $100 million into a business that earns 20% on that capital, $20 million, ideally it would be able to earn 20% on $120 million the following year, and on $144 million the following year, and so on. You could keep redeploying capital at those same returns over time. But there are very, very, very few businesses like that. We can move that money around from those businesses to buy more businesses." This was about as clear a lesson on business and investing as he would ever give. It explained why Berkshire was structured as it was, although what it said about the stock market's long history of disappointed investors was sobering. It explained why he was always looking for new businesses to buy and what he was planning to do with Clayton Homes. He expected to invest part of Berkshire's extra capital in Clayton so that it could survive to take market share away from its bankrupt competitors and to buy and service their portfolios of loans. The 50-some journalists from around the globe who had flown in to cover BRK Fest were more interested in PetroChina and whether that investment signaled a new interest in foreign stocks. They got their chance to ask him and Munger about it at the press conference on Sunday. Many of them wanted to ask a version of a question that they knew would resonate with their home audiences. "What stocks would you buy in Australia, Taiwan, Germany, Brazil, Russia?" Buffett stressed that he was still buying mainly in the United States. Most foreign stocks, he said, were not in his circle of competence. The PetroChina stock didn't change that. On Monday morning at the Berkshire board meeting, Buffett held a little seminar explaining to the board the things he most wanted to teach them about this year, which consisted of the risk that the dollar would decline against foreign currencies and the problems involved in the financing of mobile homes. Tom Murphy and Don Keough had just been voted in as directors, joining Charlie Munger, Ron Olson, Walter Scott Jr., Howie, Big Susie, and Kim Chase, the lone representative of the old Hathaway textile family. There had been some grumbling about these appointments, with shareholders making noises about cronyism and lack of balance and diversity. But the idea of a board of directors overseeing Warren Buffett was ludicrous. A board made up of Barbie dolls would do just as well. When the Berkshire board met, it was to listen to Buffett teach, just as every occasion, from a party to a luncheon to a sing-along with Jim Clayton, turned into an opportunity for Buffett to figuratively stand at the blackboard, fingers dusty with chalk. The reason shareholders cared about Berkshire corporate governance was not oversight, however, but the question of who would succeed Buffett, who was now almost 73. He had always said there was a name in an envelope crowning his successor, but he would not acquiesce to the pressure to reveal the name, because that would tie his hands to one person and events could change. It would also effectively begin the transition, and he certainly wasn't ready for that. There was, of course, a guessing game about who this person could possibly be. Most of the managers of the various companies Buffett bought seemed unlikely candidates. Buffett liked managers like Mrs. B, people who shunned the spotlight, who worked as tirelessly as a human anthill, but these people did not manage capital. Where was the capital allocator who could run this thing? The right person had to be willing to sit behind a desk reading financial reports all day long, yet excel at dealing with people in order to retain a bunch of managers who wished they were still working for Warren Buffett. "I have this complicated procedure I go through every morning," Buffett said, "which is to look in the mirror and decide what I'm going to do. And I feel at that point everybody's had their say." The next CEO would have to be a superb leader, and yet oversized egos need not apply for the job. As the board meeting ended on Monday, the town emptied of shareholders, and the Buffett family headed to New York for their annual trip. Every year they traditionally attended a dinner with the East Coast members of the Buffett Group, held at Sandy and Ruth Gottesman's house, where Susie would pile into Warren's lap and run her fingers through his hair, and Warren would gaze enraptured at his wife. But this year it seemed obvious that Susie wasn't feeling well. At lunch one day, dressed beautifully in a light wool skirt suit with a wraparound shawl, she ate only a tiny piece of chicken and some carrots with a glass of milk. She said she was fine, but wasn't that convincing. Within 2 weeks, shortly before they were to have left for the trip to Africa that she was so excited about, she was admitted to the hospital with another bowel obstruction. There, the doctors found that she was anemic and had an esophageal ulcer. In a huge disappointment for the family, at least some in the family, the Africa trip had to be postponed by a year to the following spring. Even Warren was dismayed because he knew how much the trip meant to Susie. But, asked if he was worried, he said, "Oh, no, it would bother Susie if she thought I was worrying about her. She wants to worry about me, not the other way around. She's a lot like Astrid in that sense. I'm not a worrier in general, you know." Although the reason for the cancellation was regrettable, it turned out to be a good thing that Buffett was around that June. As the meeting at which the Clayton shareholders would vote on the merger approached, opposition to the deal swelled like a blister chafed by shareholders' resistance to the price, even to the very idea of selling to Berkshire. Rumors started that another bidder would come in. Investors assumed that Buffett was going to make a lot of money, because with Berkshire's hoard of capital and good credit rating, he could fund the Claytons more or less forever on terms more attractive than anyone except a sovereign government. It seemed almost unfair. Some of the shareholders were convinced that the Claytons had sold out to Buffett too cheap in order to keep their jobs and benefit themselves, or to get access to that war chest. The potential conflict of interest when the management of a public company wanted to sell the company to Berkshire was about to set off a war. William Gray of Orbis Investment Management, for one, thought the Claytons were heisting the company on behalf of Buffett. He filed a petition with the SEC and a lawsuit with the Chancery Court in Delaware, where Clayton was incorporated. His argument was that the Claytons were not trying to get the best deal for shareholders because they had signed the exclusive clause preventing them from entertaining competing offers. He sought a ruling that they not be allowed to vote their shares on the deal and wanted a special shareholder meeting called to replace the Clayton board. "After all," said one investor, "if Buffett bids for something, it must by definition be undervalued." Buffett's reputation, which had been an asset for so many years, had begun to work against him in certain other ways as well. He was such a magnet for publicity that anyone who wanted publicity for themselves or their cause could hijack his shareholder meeting or misappropriate his fame to get it. And so it happened that just before the shareholder meeting, and around the time that Berkshire had announced the Clayton deal, Doris Christopher, CEO of The Pampered Chef, called him with just such a problem. The Pampered Chef sold kitchenware at home parties through independent salespeople, mostly women. After Berkshire's purchase of the company, members of pro-life organizations had begun boycotting their parties. Berkshire's position was that it made no donations to pro-choice or reproductive rights groups, but only acted as a conduit for its shareholders, who, through the charitable contributions program, had the right to allocate $18 per share to the charity of their choice. Of the $197 million that had been donated to nonprofit groups of all types, the largest number of recipients were schools and churches, many of them Catholic, and most of the money went to causes not related to abortion. But a significant amount of money had gone to reproductive rights organizations. As it happened, Warren and Susie's personal share of the contributions, about $9 million in 2002, went to the Buffett Foundation, where it mostly funded reproductive rights. That Berkshire's money should be funneled this way was what was bothering the pro-life groups. The argument that the contributions were not Berkshire's fell on deaf ears. In 2002, Buffett had tried to square things with one of these groups by showing them how much money went to causes other than family planning. He got a reply from the president of Life Decisions International saying, "Even if only $1 went to Planned Parenthood and $1 billion was donated to pro-life organizations, the former gift would still land Berkshire Hathaway on the boycott list." If the price of filling a parking meter was enough to attract a boycott, that was a pretty clear sign that Berkshire would find little room for compromise. Doris Christopher had tried to mediate, telling her people that while she personally did not agree with Buffett, it is not my place to ask or to judge how he donated money. Fewer than 1,000 of the 70,000 Pampered Chef consultants were petitioning Christopher over this issue. Still, the boycott was affecting business and hurting the people involved. They were being intimidated by pro-life picketers who were now making appearances at the hosts' houses during sales parties. Christopher called Buffett to tell him the disruption to her business was getting worse. "She didn't ask me, but I could tell she was hoping I would cancel the program. And, you know, I'll do it. I thought we could tough it through, but we can't. It's hurting too many people that I don't want to hurt. It hurts Doris, and these are her flock. They're getting injured, and they're innocent. They're in her office crying." In late June, Buffett called Alan Greenberg, his former son-in-law and executive director of the Buffett Foundation, into his office and explained that he had talked to Charlie Munger. Rather than sell the Pampered Chef, one of the options, they had decided to shut down the charitable contributions program. Greenberg was astounded. The year before, 97% of shareholders had defeated a resolution by a pro-life shareholder to cancel the program. Combing his hands through his dark, wavy hair, he paced back and forth, pointing out that the contributions came from individuals, not the corporation. People could still donate on their own. Shutting down the program would accomplish nothing. But Buffett had made up his mind. Greenberg returned to his office to draft a press release that went out to the newswires right before Sun Valley, over the 4th of July weekend. The phone rang and rang for several days. The secretaries grew weary from ferrying messages up and down the hall. Life Decisions almost instantly put out its own release, dropping Berkshire from its boycott list. But Buffett's friends, no matter what their views on abortion, mostly reacted the same way. They were stunned. Some were angry. "I was surprised that he gave in on that," one said. "It didn't sound like him to back down so easily. Warren is such a principled person. Was it such a big deal that it had to be done?" asked another. Though other people in his position might have chosen to stand up to the right-to-lifers, Buffett said he was worried that such a stance might put the Pampered Chef consultants at risk. He didn't say it, but implicitly, not just their livelihoods, but their physical welfare was at stake. Buffett himself was a very big target, not just Sid the dry cleaner down on the corner whom nobody had ever heard of. Taking a stand might make Berkshire Hathaway, as well as him, a symbol of pro-choice defiance, which was dangerous. He shrank from confrontation anyway. This was something he simply could not do. Afterward, he never showed any sign of rancor over the criticism or the pro-life victory laps. "You can always tell them to go to hell tomorrow," as Murph said. There was never any need to do it today. Over the years, he had saved himself a lot of trouble by following this advice. Almost as soon as he got past the pampered chef's sidebar, he simply stopped thinking about it. Alas, this did not solve the other problem caused by being Warren Buffett instead of Sid the dry cleaner. Shareholders at Clayton Homes had begun weighing in for and against the Berkshire bid as the July 16th meeting to vote on the deal approached. Prices of peer companies had started to float upward. Lenders suddenly became more lenient. The argument about the bottom of the cycle gained currency. About 13% of the investors, including respected money managers like Brandywine Asset Management, Schneider Capital, and CalPERS, the California Public Employees Retirement System, said publicly that they would oppose the deal. Kevin Clayton trotted around the country, meeting with investors and pitching the merger, while Orbis and other naysayers worked the phones and the press. By then, Berkshire had lent $360 million to Clayton to finance its stopgap needs. Buffett put out a news release in which he said he would not raise his price now or in the future. If the deal fell through, he would walk away. He also used the release to give an economic forecast for the industry, saying no turnaround was coming. Before Buffett bid, nobody had wanted Clayton. Despite a faithful following of hardcore shareholders, it was like a good-looking girl who couldn't get a partner at the dance. Now she was on Warren Buffett's arm, headed to the middle of the floor as the fiddlers and pickers began the schottische. The former wallflower suddenly looked prettier to others. At midnight, 2 days before the shareholder meeting, Cerberus Capital, which had outbid Buffett on Conseco's lending business, faxed a letter to Clayton suggesting that it was likely to make a higher bid. When it came to money, Buffett's attitude was defiant. "Okay, let them," he said. He was certain that Clayton, without Berkshire, wasn't worth more than $12.50 a share. And indeed, by the day of the meeting, exactly zero other bidders had emerged for Clayton Homes. It was still a toss-up whether the Claytons had enough votes to win approval of the sale, however. Jim Clayton faced an hour-long barrage of questions from agitated shareholders who had packed the auditorium where the meeting was held. Manufactured housing stocks had been on a tear since the deal was announced, making the $12.50 price look even worse by comparison. Some shareholders wanted Cerberus to have a chance to make its offer, even though it had had 2 months to prepare a bid and there was no way to be certain that Cerberus was serious about buying Clayton, as opposed to showing up as a spoiler to Buffett by coming in at the last minute. The Claytons were caught in a terrible bind. If the vote failed, which it very well might do, for one large shareholder, Fidelity Investments, had announced its intention to change its vote from yes to no, there might be no deal, and Clayton could get sued for having signed the agreement not to consider other bids. If the vote passed and Clayton sold to Berkshire, Clayton could get sued for ignoring another, possibly higher bid. Kevin Clayton left the meeting to call Buffett and ask him to agree to a delay on the vote, to allow Cerberus time to make a bid. Buffett said okay, if they would pay Berkshire $5 million for the delay. Clayton agreed to Buffett's price, reconvened the meeting, and adjourned it before taking a vote. By now, the business press was covering the story as a David and Goliath set piece in which a gang of tiny Davids, the hedge funds that were fighting the deal, tried to defeat the greedy Claytons and the colossus Buffett. Journalists are automatic skeptics of establishment figures. Hedge fund managers, by and large, are anti-establishment by nature. They had learned to play the press for mutual benefit like a virtuoso with his Stradivarius. The press turned on the mighty Buffett. If he was buying something, the price must be too cheap. The test of whether Buffett was stealing Clayton would be whether another bidder could be found. A week later, when 70 accountants, lawyers, and financial specialists from Cerberus Capital and three other firms, the Blackstone Group, Credit Suisse, and Texas Pacific Group, descended on Knoxville, Tennessee, led by the Cerberus chairman, former Vice President Dan Quayle, the clock began to tick toward the moment of truth. Clayton housed them in its fanciest mobile homes, adjoining the headquarters. Most of the team toured Clayton's plants and poured through rooms full of documents, focusing increasingly on the huge maw of the mortgage unit and the way it sucked down capital. Quayle roamed the hallways, shaking hands, repeating that Cerberus was a family-friendly company. While Cerberus and the other firms were deliberating, the Denver Area Meat Cutters and Employers Pension Plan filed a lawsuit against Clayton, charging it with self-dealing, abusive control, and lack of candor. Buffett felt he was being blackmailed. The Meat Cutters Union lawsuit was orchestrated by Darren Robbins, a partner of Milberg Weiss, a law firm that specialized in representing investors in class action lawsuits. "It's a well-known fact that they committed a fraud," said Robbins. 22 plaintiffs' lawyers, assistants, and researchers descended upon Knoxville. Plaintiffs' lawyers do not stay in mobile homes. They reportedly bunkered into 9 luxury condominiums downtown, ready for a 6-month battle. After a week of their own digging, the Cerberus people returned to New York and faxed a sheet labeled, "For Discussion Purposes Only, Clayton Recapitalization, Sources and Uses." The sheet was not an offer, but it contained a price, $14 a share. The Claytons' first impression was that Cerberus had beaten Buffett's offer by a healthy margin. However, a closer look revealed that Cerberus planned to give shareholders only $755 million in cash, whereas Buffett's $1.7 billion was an all-cash deal. Under the Cerberus deal, the outside shareholders would get $9 a share out of the $14 total. The balance would be paid in a recapitalized stock. The $9 a share, however, would actually be paid by Clayton itself. Cerberus wasn't going to invest any money. Clayton would have to borrow $500 million and sell off $650 million of assets. This was a typical leveraged buyout proposal, in which a company's assets are sold and it takes on debt in order to finance its own sale. The recapitalized stock, nominally worth $5, would consist of a piece of a financial company that had piled additional debt on top of a shrunken capital base. Debt was the blood coursing through the veins of mobile homemakers. Without it, they were dead. And lenders were already shying away from the business. Why would they lend to a company whose ability to repay them had just been gutted? The Cerberus people obviously knew this. They had delivered a proposal that was the best that financial engineering could do. The Claytons called Cerberus to discuss it, and, without any rancor, they agreed to go their separate ways. But CNBC and the financial press were now portraying Buffett as a ruthless financier who had connived with the Claytons to buy the company cheap. The way that the Clayton deal was playing out in the media, and the manner in which Buffett's reputation had compounded to the point where it worked against him, represented a dramatic reversal in the image of the wise, grandfatherly man who attracted legions of would-be coattail riders. The blister had popped. The opposition to the Clayton merger showed that large investors were no longer coattail riding, waiting for his reputation to take prices higher. They wanted to use his reputation against him, to block him. Buffett, however, had never really specialized in buying things that other people wanted at a price that was too cheap. Instead, he bought things that other people didn't want and thought that they were better off without. True, they had often been mistaken about that. Increasingly, since the Buffalo Evening News, however, Berkshire had bought properties that most people really were better off without. There weren't many companies that had the balance sheet to look a union in the eye and stare them down, that had the financial wherewithal to finance Clayton's debt, that could make decisions on deals like long-term capital in an hour rather than a week. Berkshire could do all those things, and more. Many of the companies Berkshire was now buying were businesses like NetJets, built by entrepreneurs who wanted to sell to a buyer who would treat their babies well and who trusted Berkshire to behave honestly. Buffett's real brilliance was not just to spot bargains, though he certainly had done plenty of that, but in having created, over many years, a company that made bargains out of fairly priced businesses. On what turned out to be Susie Jr.'s 50th birthday, the adjourned Clayton shareholder meeting finally reconvened. After 4 months, no other bidder had come forward, and Cerberus had declined to make a deal. In the end, 52.3% of the shareholders voted for the Berkshire deal. Barely enough. Excluding the Claytons, the other shareholders had voted no by a margin of 2-1. Buffett sat by the phone until he got the news. Then he took his daughter out and gave her the gift he had selected for her with the help of Susan Jacques at Borsheim's, an eternity ring crowned with a large, pink, heart-shaped diamond, and her latest million-dollar birthday gift. The supposedly cold-blooded financier was a soft-hearted sentimentalist when it came to his daughter, with whom he had an increasingly close and even dependent relationship. He had been carrying this ring around for a couple of weeks, pulling it out to look at it and getting teary-eyed with anticipation of his daughter's reaction. When Susie Jr. saw the ring, she threw her arms around him and cried. While they were hugging, Milburgh Weiss and Orbis's William Gray were already starting to try to undo the vote. Gray challenged the election and won the right to audit the ballots. The Delaware Chancery Court upheld the vote. Handed defeat, Orbis then joined with Milburgh Weiss to ask Tennessee Blount County Circuit Court Judge Dale Young to restrain the deal from being consummated. Judge Young instead said the merger should proceed. With Milburgh Weiss barking at the door, the Claytons wasted no time. On August 7th, the day the merger was scheduled to close, Clayton's Delaware attorneys were waiting at the door of the Secretary of State at daybreak to file the paperwork to certify the merger. By 7:30 a.m., it was done. As soon as the merger was effective, Milburgh Weiss and Orbis rushed to file an appeal with the Tennessee Court of Appeals to overrule Judge Young's decision of the day before. The next day, the Tennessee Court of Appeals concurred and temporarily blocked the merger, which had already closed. That prevented Berkshire from paying out the proceeds. The Court of Appeals gave the lower court a homework assignment, asking it to rule on a number of issues within 2 weeks. Clayton started working to fulfill Milburgh Weiss's 18-page document request. Lawyers and company people were working almost around the clock. Kevin Clayton and his wife had just had a baby. She was colicky from a protein allergy. "It took 27 formulas before we found one from London that would work," says Clayton. "Plus, I got shingles right in the middle of it from stress. I called up my dad and said, 'Dad, this is rough.' And he said, 'Well, son, I had paralysis on the left side of my face when I was your age from stress.' Then I called up Warren, and he said, 'Well, Kevin, when I was younger, I lost a lot of my hair from stress.' I got no sympathy from either one of them." On August 18th, Judge Young ordered a trial before a jury. Clayton immediately appealed. Clayton's stock had ceased trading weeks ago, but Berkshire could not pay out the merger proceeds since the deal marinated in the galley of the appellate court. 40,000 shareholders awaited their money from Berkshire Hathaway. All $1.7 billion sat in the bank, earning interest for Berkshire. Buffett got a fax from a couple who were being foreclosed out of their home. They needed the money from the Clayton stock to pay their mortgage. "Pay what you can," he told the couple, "and just explain the situation. Probably that will be enough to avoid foreclosure." "It's the perils of Pauline," he said. The stalemate dragged on for nearly 2 weeks. Finally, as the calendar turned to September, the court found not a scintilla of evidence that the Claytons had manipulated the voting process. 6 days later, Milburgh Weiss filed an appeal with the Tennessee Supreme Court. Buffett was incredulous, or rather, he would have been incredulous had it been any law firm but Milburgh Weiss. They were still seeking to have the merger overturned. That was not going to result in a big fat check for the law firm. How did they expect to get paid? The photocopy machines were running late at night at Clayton's law firm, ka-chunking forth documents and legal bills. Buffett reasoned that Milburgh Weiss must be trying to make such a nuisance of itself that Clayton would simply pay it to go away. He talked to Kevin Clayton. "Never," Clayton vowed. Buffett mused about the historic position of the Tennessee Supreme Court, which potentially could become the first court in the history of the United States to unwind a merger that was already complete. The court, evidently finding itself of the same mind, dismissed the appeal. Clayton's insurance company, St. Paul, wanted to settle the remaining shareholder suit filed by Milberg Weiss for $5 million. The Claytons and Buffett hated the thought of paying people they considered stick-up artists and ambulance chasers because so little of the money would go to the shareholders, maybe a nickel a share. The lawyers would get most of the money. However, the insurer argued that unless they settled, the legal bills would cost the company even more. Feeling ransomed, they went ahead and paid, and thus ended the battle to buy Clayton Homes. But it soon became clear that sales of manufactured housing were not going to turn around. Buffett had not bought just as the bounce was coming back. In fact, as Ian Jacobs had flown back to report, the downward spiral in manufactured housing had just begun. The price that had looked so cheap was barely reasonable. To help the deal's economics, Buffett had Kevin Clayton begin buying portfolios of distressed loans. It was going to take some mighty fine footwork to make the Clayton deal work out.